I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro has still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hoped that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must be able to conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring." Yeah. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom reign. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
And that was Dr. Martin Luther King, 1963. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Let's all try and have the dream that Dr. King had. The answer is not in looting and in burning. The answer is in talking. We'll be back after these messages. It's Conversation 94 WIP. The time 6:18. And we're back. It's Conversation. My conversation this morning is with John Dowling. John is one of the authors of a book, along with his brother. That new book talks about eyes, vision, how it works, and what we can do, what we do wrong with it. Good morning, John Dowling.
Good morning.
Okay.
You awakened me early this morning.
Waking myself early too, but that's another discussion. All right, John, how did you get into this business of eyes? I mean, you're a researcher at Harvard University, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay, let me tell you, I maybe head back even a little bit further. As a young boy growing up, I was always interested in science things, how things work, and I used to make all sorts of things. My father was a physician, actually an ophthalmologist. And when I went off to college, I went to Harvard. I majored in biology with the thought that I would become a physician like my father. But it was not my father's influence or even my brother, who is an ophthalmologist as well, that brought me into vision. But a professor I had when I was a junior, he was a biochemist. His name was George Wald, and he had discovered the role of vitamin A in vision. And he taught biochemistry and was a wonderful teacher. The first semester usually talked about the great metabolic pathways, which if any of your listeners have been through that kind of a course, it can get very tedious, very uninteresting at times. But Wald brought it to life. He was mesmerizing without any question. Then in the second semester, he had a course called Topics in Biochemistry, and he talked about fascinating things. One that remains with me to this day is his description of Albert St. George's experiments on muscle fibers. St. George discovered vitamin C and had won a Nobel Prize for that. But when he came to this country in the late 40s, he began working on muscle. And what he showed was that if you take a piece of muscle from a rabbit or a frog and you extract all the small molecules from the muscle, which can be easily done with something like glycerol. You have a piece of inner tissue. But if you put back on that tissue an energy-rich molecule called ATP, the muscle would contract. And when I heard that story, I was just fascinated. It seemed to me to be getting at the essence of life. So at that point, I approached Professor Wald and said, could I do some research in your laboratory? I had never done any before, and he accepted me into the laboratory, and that changed my life. That was, again, between my junior and senior years at Harvard. And the senior year, I spent almost the entire year in his laboratory doing research. And I found it very exciting. I then went off to medical school, but used to come back on odd afternoons and in the summer between the first and second year of medical school. And after 2 years, which is the preclinical years in medical school, I decided to take a leave of absence to come back and do research full-time for 1 year. Hopefully, I thought, to get the research bug out of my system. Well, I took a leave of absence. That was 50 years ago, and I'm still doing research and enjoying it enormously. So that may be more of an answer than you wanted, but it sort of gives you a feeling of how I got into research, who was most important in my life and doing that, and so on and so forth.
Now, you and your brother wrote this book. Was it
right.
easy or hard?
Yes, we did it together. My brother was an ophthalmologist, like my father. And he became an ophthalmologist because he found ophthalmology a very challenging specialty encompassing many aspects of medicine, from surgery to diagnosis to prevention to chronic conditions and so on and so forth. And, of course, over the years we stayed in touch, but I was interested in basic science. How does the eye work, particularly the retina of the eye, which sits in the back of the eye, and that's where vision starts. At the very back of the eye are the photoreceptors, the cells that absorb the light and initiate the process of vision. But in addition to the photoreceptors, the retina, which sits in the back of the eye, is which is a true piece of the brain actually pushed out into the eye during development, consists of another four or five types of neurons that start the processing of the visual image. And that's what I've spent most of my career studying. How does the retina work? I use the retina and the eye as a model piece of the brain, trying to understand how the cells that receive input from the photoreceptors are wired together, how they pass on that information to second-order cells, and then how the second-order cells pass on the information to third-order cells. And it's the third-order cells whose long axonal processes, these are the processes that neurons extend and carry information, how those processes gather at the optic nerve and carry the visual message from the eye to the rest of the brain. And so, you know, over the years I've been interested then in the wiring of the retina, the physiology of the retina, how do the cells respond when light activates the photoreceptors, then the pharmacology. What are the molecules, what are the substances that neurons in the retina use to communicate with one another? Then more recently, I've been interested in the genetics of the retina and so on and so forth. So how did this book come about? Well, in 2008, I was approached by the chairman of the board of the Lasker Foundation of New York, who, in conjunction with the International Retinal Research Foundation, were starting an initiative looking at the major eye diseases and what we might do to accelerate progress in understanding these diseases. And when I said, why me? I'm not a clinician. They said, we think that somehow we need to bring together the basic science and the clinicians to really move things forward. So I accepted the chairmanship of that initiative. And it lasted for 10 years until 2018. It just finished a year ago. And during those 10 years, we did studies on four major topics. The first one was on glaucoma and the possible role of glial cells in that disease. So we did four studies, each of which took 2 years. We gathered together the best people that we could find in basic science who were interested in this disease, the best people we could find in the clinical sciences in this area, and others that we thought might contribute substantially. And so we had workshops and then a final plenary session in the following spring. And from that we wrote a report. So in total, we wrote four reports, the first one on glaucoma, the second one on diabetic retinopathy, the third one on restoring vision to the blind, and then the last one, the fourth one, on amblyopia, the loss of vision when the two eyes are not seeing properly. And that can be caused by crossed eyes or cataract or something like that. And in the course of that 10 years, I appreciated then how important it was that basic science and the clinical sciences get together and discuss their mutual interests and what needs to be done. So towards the end of that 10 years, I thought, gee, we should write a small book for the public, for the basic scientist who wants to know more about eye diseases, and for the clinician who wants to know more about our present understanding of basic visual mechanisms. So I started the book. I was on a leave in Germany. This was back in 2013. And as I was writing it, I came to realize I really needed some expertise on the clinical side. So when I came back from Germany with a very rough draft of what I wanted to do, I approached my brother and said, let's do this together. And that's the way the book started. And it's a unique book in the following senses. There are very few books out there that really try to combine basic science of a set of diseases that occur in a particular area of the body and the clinical sciences, and that is accessible both for the basic scientists, the clinical scientists, and even the public. So that was the origin of the book. And we had a good time doing it. Many arguments, but we survived it, and I think the book came out fairly well.
So you don't need a PhD in clinical chemistry or biology to read the book?
That's exactly what we aim for. You do not. We've tried to stay out of the weeds, both on the clinical side and on the basic science side, to make it accessible to people who've had essentially no more than high school science, a little chemistry, a little physics, and when I say a little, I mean a very little. And so that was the idea. But you see, we all at some point, you know, have visual problems as we age. I mean, the obvious one is farsightedness that we all get because our lenses aren't as good in focusing images onto the photoreceptors on the retina. And so we all end up, virtually everyone end up having to wear glasses. But then there are other major eye diseases that affect people as they age, or even as younger people, that we try to deal with today and fairly successfully. So, for example, many people develop cataracts, and today in the West, cataract surgery is phenomenal. We'll come back and discuss some of the great advances there, if you would like, later on. But then age-related macular degeneration, where the center of the eye and that area called the fovea, which is so critical for high-resolution vision, when that gets diseased. And again, it's age-related macular degeneration. What can we do about that? Can we help that? And so on and so forth. So, you know, and then diabetic retinopathy, which is an offshoot of diabetes, is also a problem for many people as they age, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, accidents to the eye, retinal detachment, which can be dealt with today very successfully, and so on and so forth. So it was with all of that in mind that we wrote the book. We made it short, and we hope in language that everybody can understand, with just a little science background. And, you know, I hope it is useful. Again, I think it is unique in that there are very few books that really relate to clinical and the basic sciences of major parts of the body that, as we age, run into difficulties.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning is John D. Dowling, professor, research professor of neurosciences at the Department of
Molecular and
Cellular Biology at Harvard University, and one of the authors of the new book with his brother, that new book being Vision, How It Works and What Can Go Wrong. My name's Peter Solomon. Now, doctor, you mentioned glaucoma.
Right.
I remember my grandmother when I was little had these Coke bottle glasses. And I was told that they were related to glaucoma. Is that true?
They can be, but she probably had very severe myopia, that is nearsightedness, which required very strong glasses. And clearly myopia is a risk factor for glaucoma. But the biggest risk factor for glaucoma is increased pressure in the eye. And so the way it's treated today is, of course, to put drops in the eye that lower the intraocular pressure. And that's quite successful. It doesn't work for everybody, but for many people with glaucoma, the therapies that we presently have to lower eye pressure work quite well and over long periods of time. My guess is also another risk factor for glaucoma is cataract surgery, but that's diminishing because we've been so successful in modifying how cataract surgery is done. Cataracts are the leading cause of blindness in the world, the surgery to deal with cataracts goes way back in history. Initially, it was done by ophthalmologists taking a little needle, putting it in the eye to dislodge the lens of the eye, which is where the cataract is. It's the clouding of the lens that make it difficult for images to fall on the photoreceptors that is the underlying basis of cataracts. And initially it was to get rid of the lens that was the problem. The lens was just attached, and then the lens fell to the bottom of the eye. Now, what was the result was that people who had had severe cataracts and were having difficulty seeing anything now all of a sudden had much more light flooding into the eye. Unfortunately, without a lens, then the focus was poor. So at that point, you needed to wear very, very thick glasses. But even more recently then, what surgeons learned to do is to go into the eye, and this was even in my father's time at the beginning of beginning of the 20th century, is you could go into the eye with fine surgical tools and remove the lens. And that, again, was a real step forward when you could remove the lens surgically. But today, we are in in an amazing situation with regard to cataract surgery. For example, no longer do you need to remove the lens, but you can emulsify it with ultrasound. It's called phacoemulsification. And so you essentially get rid of the lens by sucking out the lens that you have emulsified, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And another huge advance is the use of now of artificial lenses that you can insert into the eye. That's an interesting story. I just recounted for your readers. It actually goes back to the Second World War when an ophthalmologist in southern England, a man by the name of Harold Ridley, was visited one day by a fighter pilot who came into his office and said, "Doc," I said, "you know, about 6 or 8 months ago, on a mission over Germany, a bullet hit my windshield and a piece of plastic flew off and entered my eye. It's never really bothered me, but I thought maybe I ought to talk to somebody about whether it should be removed or not." So Ridley looked into his eye and was astonished to see a sizable piece of plastic in his eye, but that the eye tolerated that piece of plastic extraordinarily well. There was no immune reaction to the piece of plastic. It seemed to be perfectly happy there in the eye. And he thought, gee, maybe what we can do is make artificial lenses with plastic and insert them in place of the removed eye, of the removed lens. And so he worked on that and eventually came up with something that works extraordinarily well. So today, if you have a cataract...
Hello? And you're listening to...
And it requires such a small incision, you don't even need stitches. In other words, with the ultrasound, you emulsify the lens so that you can then suck it out with a very fine, what we call pipette, and then you can insert in the little tiny incision the plastic lens that then can be put in and replace the lens that was there to begin with. But it can go on, it goes on even further than that, in that they now have some lenses that can change their shape. You can see near or far with the artificial lenses. More often what is done is if it's a bilateral cataract procedure, and because if you get a cataract in one eye, you tend to get a cataract in the other eye, is what you can do is put a lens in one eye that allows you to achieve near, i.e. reading and recognizing faces and so on and so forth. And in the other eye, you put a lens in that allows you to see things at some distance away for driving and what have you. And so you can use one eye for reading, the other eye for long-distance vision. It's really remarkable. I remember my father talking about cataract surgery in his day. This goes back into the 1920s. And he said, you know, that was a major operation at that point, at least as far as eye surgery was concerned. And so after we did a cataract surgery, we made the patient stay in bed for 4 days with the head immobilized so that, you know, that there was no problem with the eye healing. Today, it's done in 20 minutes and you're on your way in another 10 or 15 minutes. It's really astonishing. That's one of the real great success stories in ophthalmology, cataract surgery. Unfortunately, of course, in many third world countries, they don't have the surgeons that available to remove the cataracts. But they're beginning to even teach nurse practitioners how to do the procedure so that cataract surgery is becoming more and more available throughout the world. But if there was a way we could stop the cataract formation, and there are basic scientists working on this, it would be a great advance.
Now, I've had people in my family who've had cataract problems. And
right.
They talked about you have to wait for the cataract to ripen. What's that?
Well, because cataract surgery used to be, a difficult procedure when you had to remove the whole lens and so on and so forth. Eye surgeons didn't want to remove the cataract, the lens that was cloudy, until vision was very poor. That's changed today. In other words, if a patient comes to an ophthalmic surgeon and says, gee, doc, I'm having problems seeing things as clearly as I used to, but I can still read to some extent, and I can do this and that and so on and so forth, the physician will say, let's do the cataract surgery. We'll get rid of the cloudy lens, put in the artificial lens, and it's really an optional surgical procedure, one that improves your quality of life. So it used to be that until the cloudiness of the lens was so severe and was called right, that the surgeon wouldn't operate. But that's not the case today.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it is a tremendous advance. But there are many other advances that we've also had in ophthalmology. I sound like a clinician, which I am not, but I see what is going on. So, for example, it used to be that retinal detachment was a huge problem. That is, if you're hit on the side of the head or an eye has a contusion, that means something hard hits it, often the retina will come off the back of the eye. And when that happens, because the retina, particularly the photoreceptors, depend on the back of the eye for nutrition, oxygen, and so on and so forth, vision is lost in that part of the retina. And if one part of the retina comes off the back of the eye, a good deal of the rest of the retina may also come off the back of the eye. Well, today with lasers, what you can do is tack the retina back on to the back of the eye, and it works very, very effectively. The first treatment for retinal detachment used to be to make the eye a little smaller so that the back of the eye was pushed back towards the retina rather than the retina being pushed back on the back of the eye. That was a heroic technique developed by a man by the name of Charles Scapins in Boston, and worked surprisingly well, but it was a long operation, a tedious operation, and not always successful. Today with lasers surgery, it's almost a trivial procedure and extraordinarily successful. So I just talked about a couple of advances that have been made over the last half century or even a little longer that have made a huge difference. And of course, things are going on all the time that are advancing things. So, for example, we know of a number of inherited eye diseases. One of the most common, although it's fairly rare, fortunately, is called retinitis pigmentosa. And what happens there is that the photoreceptors, and we have two types of photoreceptors, rods, which mediate our dim light vision, and cones, which operate during the day, so they're responsive to brighter lights, but they also mediate our color vision. And in retinitis pigmentosa, first it's the rods that disappear, but eventually the cones go too. Well, the genes which cause that inherited disease have been identified, and it turned out, much to our surprise, that there are many, many genes that are mutated that cause this disease. But it suggested that we can, by replacing a particular gene, be able to cure that inherited disease. And the first gene therapy was just approved a year or so ago by the FDA, and now is being successfully used to treat that form of inherited retinal blindness. And though that's a huge advance, it's one of the first successful gene therapies in any branch of medicine. So that's been a great, great advance. And it's the kind of thing that's going on. I mean, we're even beginning to deal with the complete blindness with what we call visual prostheses. That is, when the photoreceptors have degenerated, of course, then there's no longer any vision because there's nothing to receive the light or absorb the light. And visual prostheses, that is, little devices that are photosensitive, can be put into the eye. They stimulate the retinal circuitry that remains. It's just the photoreceptors in many cases that have degenerated. And so we can restore some vision that way. Doesn't give you the high-resolution vision yet that we're all hoping we can provide to people who are completely blind. But what's astonishing is people who haven't seen any light, anything, for 10 or 15 years, when given this device, it's implanted in their eyes, now can see light. Resolution is not all that good so far, but it's coming along. But they can avoid large objects, and so for their visual situation, it's a huge improvement. And there are many other techniques that are coming along in the basic science laboratories that we think will be equally important, if not more important, in restoring vision to the blind. There's a technique called optogenetics, in which a gene is inserted into the eye that renders cells in the eye photosensitive. It can be remaining photoreceptors, if there are any left, but it can also be the second order neurons or even the third order neurons that one can make light sensitive. And that's not in the clinic yet. It's getting close to the clinic. But then other basic scientists are trying to transplant cells back into an eye in which certain cells have deteriorated, degenerated photoreceptors and other cells in the eye. And indeed, there's great interest in using stem cells, of course, stem cells which can form any kind of cell, putting those into the eye and seeing if one can get those stem cells to replace cells in the eye that have degenerated. So, there's lots going on, and we're making an enormous amount of progress. And all of this we cover in the book. With a fairly light hand, if you will, that is, to make it accessible to the public and to as far as the basic science is concerned, palatable for the clinician, and as far as the clinical side of things, palatable for the basic scientist.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, John Dowling.
And we're back. It's 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon, and we've eased on out of conversation and into WIP Sunday. Here on 94 WIP. Would we come back in just a minute? An intriguing piece of history. One act can change the world. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. All this and more when we come up here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. More in just a bit. Just say, play 94 WIP, WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon, and you can learn things every day here on 94 WIP. Today we go back in history to the time of World War II and the planning and execution of the Tehran Conference that brought together Joseph Stalin, Franklin Roosevelt, and Winston Churchill. So let's say good morning to my guest this morning, Howard Blum. Good morning, Howard Blum.
Nice to speak with you.
Thank you. Howard, tell me about the book and how you came across the information.
Well, I first became involved in trying to find the story of what really happened at Tehran when I came across a press conference that FDR gave when he returned from Tehran. He was in the Oval Office. He spoke to the assembled reporters, and he announced that there was a security problem during the course of the conference. He had to move from the American embassy to the Russian embassy because there were some Nazi commandos on the loose. And then he turns to the press. He gives a small laugh, and he says it would have been a pretty good haul if they could have gotten all three of us. That's FDR, Churchill, and Stalin. And reporters laugh too. And then this conversation is dropped. Reporters never follow up. And over the years, there have been references to this, but I went back through the archives. I went through Russian recently declassified files, and I put together the pieces. And it was a fantastic story that was revealed. When Hitler realized the war was being lost on the battlefields, he launched a desperation, almost impossible mission. The mission to assassinate the three Allied leaders, FDR, Churchill, and Stalin, at the Tehran conference in a bold commando raid. The assassins, these were a specially trained group of SS men, paratroop troops, who had been trained by the man the Allies identified as the most dangerous man in Europe. The stakes were nothing less than the future of the world. And one man, Mike Riley, FDR's Secret Service bodyguard, the head of the detail, had to work with the Russians to thwart this threat against the future of the world.
A secret's only a secret, though, when three people know it and two of them are dead. How did this become so available in terms of the information?
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Okay. Okay. A secret's only a secret when three people know it and two of them are dead. How did we find out this information?
Well, you're right about that. The way the Nazis found out about the secret conference at Tehran was through a spy, a walk-in. A walk-in is usually the most reviled member of the intelligence community. He comes to you bearing gifts, and you don't know why he's doing it. Is it for money? Is it for his own ego? Or is he... the greatest fear that the spy masters have, is he a double agent? Is he spreading disinformation? And this spy came to the Germans and said he was the valet for the British ambassador in Ankara, Turkey, and he wanted 20,000 British pounds, and he would deliver documents from the ambassador's safe, secret cable traffic. The Germans considered this, and then they decided, well, we might as well go along with it, because they decided to pay him with counterfeit money. So the Germans had their own forgery operation going. So they pay him these 20,000 forged British pounds, and he delivers fantastic documents. The Germans are so impressed that they give him the code name Cicero, after the Roman orator who talked so eloquently. And these documents revealed that the Allies were meeting in Tehran. And Tehran was actually the worst possible place that the Allies could have chosen, because since the beginning of the war, the Nazis had a spy network set up in the city. They had safe houses, they had communications equipment, they had also been running commando operations, parachuting sabotage commandos into Iran to sabotage Allied shipments of war material. So everything was set up for these 6 days when the three Allied leaders would be in Tehran to send in an insertion team.
So the Nazis knew more than we did.
Yes, they did. When we went to Tehran, we were overwhelmed. Mike Riley is a former college football star. He was 33 years old, in charge of security for FDR. And he gets there. First, he has to look on the map where Tehran is. He had no idea. And then he gets to the American embassy, and he then goes to the British and Russian embassies where the meetings will take place, and he realizes they're 4 miles apart. And these 4 miles, FDR is going to have to travel each day several times through the twisting corridors of Tehran, and this was a security, real security problem. And then there was something else, something that we can identify these days. Tehran was a hot zone. It was breeding with an invisible enemy. Typhoid was raging through the city. There were water canals on the side of the main roads, which brought in fresh drinking water, but the Iranians would also use this for dumping their refuse. So typhoid rages through the city, and FDR, his immune system was already imperiled. He had polio, and Riley was concerned what would happen. His one gave him some encouragement, the one thought that gave him some encouragement, into the American, British, and Russian embassy. They had water tunnels there were streams of fresh water coming down from the mountains through these water tunnels. Later, however, he would realize what a mistake this was, because the Nazis would use these water tunnels to try to get into the embassy compound. It was all planned to launch their attack on the three Allied leaders on the night of Churchill's 69th birthday party. And there's a photograph in my book. You can see the three Allied leaders sitting shoulder to shoulder at Churchill's 69th birthday party in the British embassy. And there's cake in front of them, and you can almost hear their voices singing happy birthday. And at that very moment, as they're singing happy birthday, six well-trained Nazi assassins were trying to make their way to the water tunnels and break in to the British embassy, go to the dining room, and change history with a frontal assault.
Now, what it was then Operation Long Jump?
Operation Long Jump was the name that Walter Schellenberg, who was the head of the German cloak and dagger operations for the SS Section 6, came up with for this operation. He recruited with Otto Scorsese, who was the most dangerous man in Europe, the assassins who would take part in this mission. The reason Scorsese got the name the most dangerous man in Europe is he was able to rescue Mussolini after he was imprisoned by the Italians. Mussolini was put on the top of a 7,000-foot mountain, and it seemed impenetrable. There was only one cable car going up to the top of the mountain. It was well guarded. You couldn't drop paratroopers because the winds were too strong. Or Scorsese came in with gliders. The gliders landed on the mountain top, and they rescued Mussolini and brought him back to Hitler's hideout in East Prussia. And Hitler then gave Scorsese the mission to rescue, to lead Operation Long Jump.
Why did it fail?
It failed. The first thing we have to realize, it came amazingly close to succeeding. Ultimately, the Russians had a double agent who was working in the SS. He alerted the Russians to the first group of paratroopers who were coming into Iran. So when these men came down out of the sky into the Iranian desert, there were Russian troops there waiting for them, and most of them were shot before they even hit the ground. At the same time, though, six paratroopers landed at another site, and these paratroopers got into the city of Tehran, and for the 4 days of the conference, Mike Riley, working with the Russians, was playing a cat-and-mouse game with these commandos. Tehran is a city of 1 million people, and Riley was leading troops door-to-door through the bazaars and marketplaces of Tehran looking for these assassins. Finally, the assassins went to ground in the house of an Iranian police lieutenant. He was bribed by the Americans to give information, and he turned in these assassins. The troops converge on the house, and the assassins blow themselves up before they can get to the water tunnels. But the fact that they were able to stay on the loose in the city for 6 days and get this close to getting the three Allied leaders is chilling to me.
How about Churchill and Stalin?
Pardon?
Obviously, Roosevelt knew what was going on. What about Churchill and Stalin? Did they know?
Yes, the three Allied leaders and their bodyguards knew. Churchill, from the moment he arrived in Tehran, was filled with fear. He was supposed to sneak into the city. It was a top-secret conference. He arrives at the airport, and there's a ceremony to greet him. And then the whole way into the city, there are Iranian cavalry troops showing the way. He is fuming. He feels that at any moment an assassin is going to shoot him. And finally, as he gets closer to the British embassy and he thinks he's going to be safe, there's a traffic jam. And he's stuck for 20 minutes in this traffic jam. And he later writes, if it had been planned to put me in the greatest danger, it could not have been more successful. He was in great fear. And he also realized that there was a previous attempt on his life by the Nazis. They had shot down a plane that they thought was carrying him, but he fortunately was not on that plane. All 13 people on the plane died, and he said he only escaped because of, quote, the inscrutable workings of fate. As for Stalin, the Nazis had also tried to assassinate him previous to this. They had placed a bomb on what they thought was his car, but they found the wrong car. So those two attempts had failed, but this Tehran mission was their last chance, they thought, to try to get the three Allied leaders. And it was particularly important because FDR had now insisted on an unconditional surrender. And this meant the German high command realized that there would be no chance of a negotiated peace. They would have to answer to a war crimes tribunal. They would have to pay for their lives for their crimes against humanity, against civilians, against Jews. And unless this would happen, unless they could do something. And so the German intelligence forces came up with the plan for Operation Long Jump.
How did stopping the plan, though, change how we protect the president?
Well, World War II was a tremendous change in itself for protecting the president. It was the first war where the enemy could send Allied bombers over Washington, D.C., where paratroopers could drop out of the sky onto the White House lawn. And FDR presented a unique challenge. He was literally a sitting target. He was paralyzed from the waist down. Mike Riley realized he would have to put his body in front of FDR if he was ever in the crosshairs of an assassin's rifle. When we went to Yalta, we were much better prepared. But when we went to Tehran, it was really a makeshift strategy. And we hadn't realized until it was almost too late how close the enemy was targeting our three leaders.
And you're listening to 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Howard Blum. Howard's new book, Night of the Assassin. All this and more when we come back here on 94 WIP, the WIP time, 717. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. I'm here with Howard Blum, the author of the new book, Night of the Assassin. Howard, how did it stay a secret for so long? I mean, the information was there. What did it take? Why did it take historians so long to find it?
It's a very good question you're asking. Part of the problem is that intelligence agencies, it's their job to keep secrets. We know about the Kennedy assassination. Files keep on getting released, but we still haven't gotten the whole story. In this case, it was a major secret after the press didn't follow up on FDR's announcement that it would have been a pretty good haul to kill the three people. And then after the war, there were some interviews with the participants, but they used pseudonyms. Then finally, the Russians released previously classified intelligence documents, and they brought forward a couple of the agents who participated with the Americans in the mission, and they were able to give eyewitness testimony. I used those Russian documents, those Russian testimonies, transcripts of them, to then go to the American, British, and German archives. I was able to put the pieces together. I was able to identify people who were called previously by pseudonyms. For example, there was a German asset, a young woman who was having an affair with the German agent in charge of Tehran. And at the same time, she was also having an affair with an American army soldier in Tehran, she had met him because he played in a jazz band that was, the Americans had sponsored in Tehran. He was a trumpet player. He, in reality, was a military intelligence agent, and you can read the transcript in the British and American archives of her interrogation where all this is revealed. So with information like that, I was finally able to put the pieces together. I also say, when I had a discussion about this at the CIA, I met with a CIA official and I told him I wanted to tell the true story of Operation Long Jump, and he started laughing. And he said, in intelligence operations, you never get the true story. There's always one more file. But until we get that final file, I'd like to think that Night of the Assassins is a well-documented and well-sourced accounting of what happened in Tehran during those 4 days that the conference took place.
Why is it important that we know the story?
Well, it's important for a lot of reasons. We're living through a time now when we can see every day how leadership affects our lives, or the lack of leadership. We look to our leaders to get us through the crisis, to ensure that there's a better tomorrow, and to make the changes that are necessary to lead us into this tomorrow. This was important in times of war and in times of peace. And we also see today how life can change just like that. I mean, the world we're living through today was previously unimaginable this time last year. So we can see how an attack on the three Allied leaders could have changed the course of World War II if it had succeeded. They had come to Tehran with one goal in mind, largely. They were planning D-Day. We celebrated yesterday the 76th anniversary of D-Day, and this was a acrimonious debate about how D-Day should be handled. The Americans wanted to go across the channel, a straight line from France to Berlin. Churchill, however, wanted to go up through what he called the soft underbelly of Europe, through Italy and southern France. And this debate raged until finally it was resolved at the Tehran conference. If the three Allied leaders had been assassinated at Tehran, D-Day might have been delayed. It might never have taken place. World War II, it might have been negotiated peace rather than the unconditional surrender, and the world would be quite a different place than it is today.
Amen to that. The Germans involved were probably somewhat lucky that they got caught and dealt with, because if they had to go home to Hitler empty-handed, their fate would have been much worse.
Well, they went off determined to make history, and these were commandos who had gone off on previous impossible missions that succeeded, and that's at the end, they literally blew themselves up. They had specially designed bombs that they were going to throw into the dining room at Churchill's birthday, and they used them at the end when they were surrounded rather than surrender to commit suicide, to go up in flames rather than be caught.
I would imagine Mrs. Stalin, Clementine Churchill, and Mrs. Roosevelt wanted to smack their husbands when they got home.
I would think that might have been the case. Mrs. Roosevelt, earlier in this, is something I was reading. FDR doesn't have the nerve to tell her that Churchill's coming to visit until the last minute, until Churchill arrives in Washington, and then he tells her he's staying just for two nights. Don't get too upset. And Churchill stays for 2.5 weeks, and he's the most rambunctious house guest. As Mike Riley, who's FDR's bodyguard, writes, he's never seen anyone drink so much, and that includes the entire Washington press corps, he says.
Amazing. And I want to say thank you to my guest, Howard Blum. Howard, what's next?
Well, I'm doing another true life spy story. I'm going to, hopefully, Night of the Assassins is going to be made into a movie. So I've been with conversations about that, and I'm focusing on the script for that.
Well, thank you to Howard Blum, historian, author, his new book, Night of the Assassin. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you. Nice speaking with you.
My pleasure. Bye. And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. More good talk in just a bit. And we're back into the final stretch of WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon, and I'm pleased to welcome here for a very enlightening, somewhat painful, and somewhat chuckling story, the new author, Dolores Johnson, author of the book, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. Good morning, Dolores Johnson.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine.
And I just want to say that my name is E. Dolores Johnson, not so as to distinguish me from another Dolores Johnson author.
Okay, E. Dolores Johnson. All right,
thank you.
Dolores, tell me about the story.
Well, Say I'm Dead is a deeply moving memoir, the true story of my family, a family who overturned generations of fear, secrets, and separation because they refused to be bound by forbidding race-mixing norms and laws. In 1943, my black father and white mother met in Indianapolis but were terrified by a local lynching and a mandatory prison time exacted for violating the anti-miscegenation laws. So they fled, got married in New York, and then lived in hiding for 36 years.
36 years. What made them come out of hiding?
They came out of hiding because of me. We were raised as black kids, and as a black woman in my 30s, I did the root search on my father's black family. And after I created this genealogy chart and saw all these people, generations on it, I realized there was only one white person on the whole sheet, and that was my mother. And the light bulb finally went off that the family we had never heard of had to be somewhere. And so I went to my family. I gathered together everyone to talk about this, and I said to them, our white family is missing. This genealogy is only half of the story, and I want to know the rest. And after a lot of really anguished conversation, my parents finally told us how they had run away, and they had never contacted her family again, and they didn't speak of that family, so we didn't know anything about them. But I said to them, I want to know where they are, and I want to go find them and look at them. I need to just see whose blood is running in my veins. And of course, my mom was tearful, and she was really just torn apart at the idea of coming out from the life she had built for all those decades that didn't include her family. But it was because I insisted that she finally gave me permission to go to Indiana and look for them. But she said to me, if you find them, I can't face them. Don't bring me into this. My family loved me. And I ran off and didn't tell them where I was, and they probably have thought I died. I can't face them now. And so if you see them, you have to tell them, she said, say I'm dead. And that's the title of the book.
That had to be very painful for your mother.
You know, she was extremely upset. And, you know, it had never dawned on us those whole 36 years that she was harboring this secret and this love for the family that she left behind. But there had been a lynching in the county by Indianapolis where they were. And the Ku Klux Klan was running the city government in Indianapolis. Lots of members were open members of the Klan. Indiana has a very racist history. Even the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan at one time was the governor of Indiana. So they knew they couldn't be together there. And she gave up everything for my dad.
There's a song from Chorus Line, What I Did for Love.
Yes. Yes, and I think a lot of people understand that, what I did for love. That's right. I guess one of the main questions of this book is, can love overcome race? And when we look at the racial unrest in the United States right now, this book, I think, gives us some ray of hope for our racial future, because we now know that, according to the census, the mixed race population is growing at an accelerating rate.
Certainly good news.
All right. I mean, the report that came out of the 2010 census said the growth rate of mixed race babies' births outstripped the growth rate for single race baby births by 3-1.
Intriguing.
It is. We're headed for a different future.
Dolores, given your background in all of this, what do you think of the recent news that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky is blocking passage of an anti-lynching law in the Senate?
It's outrageous. It's outrageous. Of course, we haven't had any tree-hanging lynchings since sometime in the 50s, but there were 4,000 of those lynchings in the United States. but we've had these other kinds of lynchings, as George Floyd is an example of a modern-day type of lynching. And for someone in our United States government not to stand up against that kind of violence against its own citizens is really outrageous.
It's enough to make you want to move to Kentucky so you can vote.
I'll let you go there.
Would you be afraid to go to Kentucky?
No. I've lived in the Deep South. I've lived in South Carolina, and I lived in Louisiana, where actually I had a cross burned on the lawn and a lot of harassment, and I had police interaction after that, which was total disinterest, unconcern, when we felt our lives were at stake. So, no, I'm not afraid to go to any state in the United States, because that experience taught me that you have to be self-caring. You can't expect the police to come to your aid as a black person and fight for your cause. That was the impression I had. So you have to, what we did after the night of the lynching is bought a gun to protect ourselves. We came from New York and went down there without ever expecting any trouble. It was after the civil rights laws had passed. And we naively thought that passing a law meant a change in everybody's behavior, but it didn't. We were We were sadly mistaken on that point. We were sadly mistaken, and I'm worried that today, with the racial unrest we see, if there are some follow-on changes to laws and policies, that we'll still have people who are not going to follow them, just as they didn't follow them down there in Louisiana when we had our incident. It's a long, long march to making things truly different.
Do you think you'll ever see it in your lifetime?
I don't. I think that if you look at the history of the March to Freedom for Black People, you know, the first chink in the racist history of America was the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. And, you know, the civil rights movement made a lot of changes and changed laws. Affirmative action came in that made it possible for people to finally have access and opportunity. But now we have today's unrest. And to me, it's like inching towards equity and equality. All of this history, so hard fought, is going to take that kind of effort and that kind of overturning of the norm for things to get better. But will they ever be? Will there ever be complete equity between the races? I don't hold that hope.
And you're listening to 94 WIPO Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's WIP Sunday. We're ending our Sunday with author E. Dolores Johnson, author of the new book, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. You have children, Dolores?
I do. I have one daughter.
What do you tell her?
We talk about this a lot. She's an adult. She's an adult who's in a mixed marriage. And raising her, you know, we talked about these things, but she had the opportunity to go to some excellent schools, which put her in a position often of being one of very few Black people. She's quite comfortable moving in white circles, but now she has a son who's mixed race, and he's just a little kid, but we're already talking about having the talk, as they call it, Black boys and the police, harm against Black bodies, so that he knows how to handle himself and to avoid the kind of altercation that can end up with you in jail or dead.
It's got to be scary as his grandmother.
It is scary to think that, you know, he's going to live a life where a brown skin is an opportunity for people to call the police on you when you're watching the birds, as the man in New York experienced, and then to have that person tell the lie that you're threatening their life so that you can get in trouble, or to have somebody's knee on your neck in the street killing you. This is what Black people live with all the time. But, you know, we say that in Say I'm Dead. I end the book on a hopeful note, as I mentioned earlier, that because of the rise in interracial births and the projections into the future, and now the many white protesters in the streets, which are so many more than we ever saw during civil rights days, that you know, there is some hope, and yet we still have to have people in the streets shouting that Black lives matter, and that is what I say at the very end of my book.
Why did you write the book?
You know, I lived as a Black woman. I went to a Black university, Howard University in Washington. I married a Black man. I was a member of the Black church. And then when I realized that my white mother's family was missing and I went to look for them, I wanted to understand both sides of my heritage. I wanted to be whole and not be... Once I knew that there was a white family, I felt like I was in between. And I needed to complete that for myself, to be a whole person. And once I did, the family that I found was so loving. They didn't want to worry about race. They wanted to worry about family love. And we were reunited as a black and white extended family for another 25 years, where we enjoyed everything that all families do, all the birthday parties, weddings, 4th of July's, and so forth. And I thought it was a remarkable story that should be told. I wrote this book because I wanted people to see the history of what it took to be in interracial marriages to bring us to today, and to also understand that family love can overcome race, and that we are not necessarily going to have separate lives.
Any nibbles from Hollywood yet?
I wish.
I mean, it sounds to me like a perfect movie for no one else. Netflix.
Well, I have had a lot of people who've read the book say that it's quite visual, and they can see, like, see it on the screen. So maybe someone will call.
From your lips to God's ears.
Yes.
What's your next book, or are you done as an author?
My next project will be a book on slavery in New England.
Huh. Because we don't tend to think of that.
I've been doing some research and discovered some quite amazing facts about the economy that was built in New England based on slave trading, and the people who held slaves, and the people who came from the Caribbean and brought their slave trading interests with them, and the universities that have been built on slave trading money. And I'm looking forward to putting that down on the page, because people think that slavery is a Southern institution, but guess what? It's not. It was completely ingrained in the fabric of New England as well.
Well, loving musicals as I do, there's a song from 1776, Molasses into Bibles to Rum.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I'm glad that you invited me today, because the book was published just this week in honor of Loving Day, which is happening on June 12th. And that is the anniversary that is celebrated each year on June 12th, marking the Supreme Court decision to overturn anti-miscegenation laws in the United States. And so I was 19 years old and a college student when this country abolished all the laws that said people can't intermarry. My parents were like the grandparents of the mixed race phenomena, because they ran away and got married 24 years before the Supreme Court said that it was legal to marry who you wanted.
What a horrible heritage, but yet what heartwarming hope.
We have a long fraught history in the United States around race mixing, and it begins with slavery. Those were the first mixed race people, the ones that were raped on plantations. And also in my book, I reveal that my great-grandmother was raped and gave birth to a mixed-race baby in 1890. That's my grandmother, who helped raise me and never spoke about the fact that she was mixed race. But when I did my family genealogy, an elderly relative in the South told me that. So I went to my grandmother and I asked her, well, you must have felt so upset and maybe even humiliated by this fact? And she said, no. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my mother's fault. That's how white men did black people, and they were free to do what they chose. We had no recourse. We had no recourse. And I asked her, did you know your father? And she said, yeah. He came around to our house every once in a while with a bag of candy, and he'd sit on the porch, give us candy. But once he crossed back off that porch, we were never to acknowledge him. And that is the history of mixed race. And we come today where we see 1 in 10 marriages in the United States are mixed race. Not just black and white, but all races, all mixtures, 1 in 10. So the ball has moved.
And thank goodness for that.
That's right. That's right.
And I'd like to say thank you to E. Dolores Johnson, author of the new book, Say I'm Dead, A Family Memoir of Race, Secrets, and Love, for reminding us 1 in 10 today. Thank you, Dolores.
Thank you.
My pleasure.